listening to The Ensign. Christian radio, unlike anything you've ever heard before. This is The Ensign at ensign-radio.com.
And if you listen carefully, you'll understand that Christmas has always been just as exciting as it is today.
But to make a profit.
Ho, ho, ho!
All the lenders and borrowers and practice of usury.
Nonsense, Cratchit! What better time with Christmas a mere 2 days away?
But to make a profit.
Ho, ho, ho!
Very stressful.
That is the room where business is conducted.
Without mentioning that the incentive is not to create a better society.
That's what's been changing.
But to make a profit.
Ho, ho, ho!
Very stressful, very stressful.
But to make a profit.
Ho, ho, ho!
That's what's been changing.
Christmas has always been just as exciting as it is today.
Very stressful, but to make a profit.
Ho, ho, ho!
That's what's been changing.
For many, the holiday season is exciting and fun. However, for others, it can be very stressful.
That's what's been changing.
But to make a profit. Stressful, but to make a profit.
Today.
But to make a profit.
And we welcome you once again to another Friday night. Watchmen on the Wall Live. It's Black Friday. If you're listening to this, you are undoubtedly not out in the corridors of commerce, commiserating with the spirits of the season. And we welcome you to this evening. A little bit of your reverence on the front end, and then we'll get serious about it and get down to brass tacks. I have with me tonight, from the West Coast, Northern California, my good friend
Gordon Comstock.
And from somewhere in the environs of New York, the East Coast,
Ed Hovind.
And good evening, gentlemen. How you doing?
Good to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's Black Friday. What more can I say? I didn't plan it. I looked at the calendar when I scheduled the show, and I went, oh, that's interesting. And of course...
Where'd that term come from, Randy? Because I don't remember that term prior to it, just a few years ago, Black Friday.
Yeah, it's because most of the retailers make most of their money, which puts them into the black on Friday.
You know,
So this is to push you over the edge and finally put you in the black. Because, you know, most of the sales, retail sales especially, are done during the Christmas holidays. So that's where these businesses would make up for the losses that they were suffering all throughout the rest of the year.
Yeah, theoretically within the next, month, they will make one-third of all of their profits for the year. Sad, isn't it? What a business model.
And it's all dependent on consumer spending, which is, of course, I think there's an occultic meaning to it as well.
Yeah,
it's all a game.
Well, Evan and I have talked before about the occult side of banking and commerce. Even the word commerce itself, if you look at it, it's attached to Mercury and the workings of commercial Babylon itself.
Yeah, that was a good show you guys did.
I don't know. I grow more irritated every year. The curmudgeon in me has solidified to the point now where I can barely stand it. I boycott every possible purchase I can make now until the end of the year. I'm not contributing to this materially in any way that I don't need to. And if I could help myself, I would lock myself up for the next month and just completely let the whole thing pass by me.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the business model requires all of this spending at this time of the year, or the economy would collapse, which is why, especially this time with this so-called recession going on, it's much more important than any other time for them to have these huge sales. I stopped by a Kmart at Penn Station before coming out to the island, and they were selling these large screen TVs, you know, 32 inches for like $300, and they had just huge stacks of them, more than I had ever seen anywhere, you know, of all these big screen TVs in anticipation that people could actually purchase these things. Now, unemployment is up over 25%. I mean, I realize this doesn't seem to be a very spiritual thing, but going back to the whole talisman issue, they have to keep us, you know, under their spell in order for this whole system to continue. And part of that is getting us to, you know, like the Pavlovian dogs, to go and buy, you know, during this so-called, you know, Black Friday, you know, to put us in, so they're into the black, and we actually now participate in bringing them into the black. So it's a kind of religious ritual at heart.
Yeah, well, it really is a religious ritual. As you know, Ev, because you unfortunately called me when I was in the noisy restaurant last Friday night. I was in New York City last weekend, and Saturday we spent several hours between things that we had planned to do that were commitments, basically mucking about Midtown Manhattan. And in fact, we did the ultimate indignity and went to FAO Schwartz and walked through that temple of Toyland and the Apple Store, and just basically New York was at that point priming the pump for what was to commence with the parade on Thanksgiving Day, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, which is really the grand kickoff for the season of commerce. But it was pretty obvious, talking even to, I was in Greenwich Village, which is where I really like to be when I'm in New York, talking to some of the shop owners there. They didn't seem to think they were going to get the bump this year from the retail sales. And in fact, some of the smaller merchants told me that they had sort of planned their lives in a different model now. They were scaling back, and they were actually attempting to pull things into a point where they were profitable throughout the year. So maybe things are looking up, at least for the small business people, which are the ones that my heart's with.
Speaking of the Macy's parade, that's a whole other religious ritual. Of course,
yeah.
culminating with Santa Claus, which, you know, I know we're, you know, a good nearly 4 weeks away from Christmas, but one of the things I wanted to talk about tonight is all of these Christmas, you know, pagan rituals that have been brought in to the, you know, to this season, and how we're basically entering into that whole occultic, you know, Gnostic other world that, which is really the other side of the whole money system. That it's all about, you know, incantations and bringing us into a kind of mesmerized, hypnotized state where, you know, like, as I said, like the dogs, we're going to salivate on command and go out and buy and consume. And this is, you know, why, you know, the stores are rushed. I mean, they were concerned about all of the, you know, potential, you know, trampling incidents that might happen from people rushing to try to get the sale.
You know, there's got to be the ultimate indignity to that, and it's not funny, but those who remember last year on Black Friday, literally, and I guess this was what, upstate New York at a Walmart, that one of the, one of the greeters at the door was literally trampled to death by the hordes of shoppers busting through the doors to go buy some more cheap junk from China. It's, you know, what a hideous indignity to lose your life in observance of this season of avariciousness. You know, I that man gave his life to commerce, and you know, I looked at that on a more metaphorical level and realized just what people will give up even in terms of dignity to go out and basically participate in this in this ritual.
Well, you guys, I thought it would take longer, but it you guys got right to it. I have to talk about 1984.
Go.
You know,
it.
I'm always going to.
Yeah.
But okay. What you mentioned that about the shopper being trampled. One of the most poignant for me, one of the most poignant moments in the novel 1984 is when Winston Smith is traveling where he shouldn't,
right,
in the Pearl sector, and he hears a yell, some people screaming around the corner, and he thinks to himself, at last, the proles are waking up. The revolution has started. They're yelling about the oppression going on, their government. And he gets around the corner, and he sees that all it is a sale on tin saucepans. And these women are beating themselves to death, trampling one another to get to this sale. And he walks away disgustedly and says, why can't people yell about things that matter? And you think of guys going to watch the Super Bowl and how much they yell about that, and women going to sales at Mervyn's, how much do they yell about that, and yet all the oppressions and the rights and privileges that are stripped away nowadays, and not a peep about that.
Well, that's the sum total of all of the conditioning that has gone on from over the last 100 years since they set down these very bankers that we talked about with the talismans, that they sit down and decided how they were going to seduce all of us to take us into their system. And now most people are victims of that. You know, all the Christmas list, all the whole Santa Claus propaganda, you know, you make your lists and who's naughty and nice, you ask Santa Claus, you know, for what, you know, the children, what they're going to get every Christmas, and then the parents go out dutifully and buy these objects for their children.
Hey, Randy?
Yes.
Speaking of Santa Claus, you and Sue did a wonderful show exposing where Santa Claus really came from that you did last year. And you said it yourself. Unfortunately, the source material you got this from was Michael Rood. And it's a shame that a whack job like him had to be the one. But he did a great job talking about the bugbear.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to say this in favor of getting that material from Michael Rood, and I'm discovering this in talking more and more to people of other faiths, that they find this to be extremely ludicrous, this whole Christmas celebration. So it's not surprising that somebody who is basically following what I consider to be rabbinical Judaism would bring these facts out. The comment came up in a show that Jeff Cross did with Zeph Daniel last weekend with a Messianic Jew on the same thing. It was one of the first accusations, not accusations, that show, by the way, is on threshingfloor-radio.com, and I recommend listeners go over and listen to that. But it's one of the first things that they want to toss at a Christian. Well, you guys have Easter bunnies and Christmas trees, and it's all unbiblical, and none of it's based on Scripture, and they're absolutely right, which is why I think we have to backpedal so furiously away from this and letting people know, look, we've seen the truth in this, and the truth of the matter is that we can't honor this anymore. Of course, it's not scriptural. In fact, it's completely pagan. And yeah,
Clement Moore, who wrote "'Twas the Night Before Christmas," was an admitted Freemason and occultist, and he created most of the man in the red suit, the white beard, the reindeer, and all of this. It came out of his mind. Of course, we know that he was a filter, a channel through which all of these occult practices going all the way back to Babylon. found their, you know, their willful expression. And all of this then came in. You know, it had been under the surface for a while with Father Christmas and all these other things, going back to, you know, to British history, but it found its full expression finally in the, you know, taking into Christian, you know, ritual, you know, the full flowering of paganism, which is what we have now. I mean, go look, watch any of these Santa Claus movies that Hollywood is so dutifully putting out almost every year.
Oh, yeah.
Getting more ridiculous, you know, each successive year. You know, Fred Claus, I think, was the last one last year, the brother of Santa Claus, and all the Tim Allen Santa Claus movies that were produced, or even going back to all, you know, the things that we were raised on when I was a child, like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Or
the Miracle on 34th Street.
All of these things going all the way back to, you know, to the early days of Hollywood were about promoting this whole kind of magical thinking of the pagans, you know, that there's somehow, you know, there are witches and elves and you know, wizards out there, and everyone, you know, should, you know, pay homage to them and, you know, and seek their, you know, good fortune.
Well, and the other thing they were always about is profit.
Did you guys hear that clip I played at the beginning of the show? Could you hear that?
No, I couldn't.
Okay, I'll see that you get a copy of that. I actually sent a copy to Visigoth today for his annual Christmas soiree as well. It's a very tongue-in-cheek parody that I put together a few years ago. It pretty much says it all. It's kind of a mashup thing. By the way, let's do some business here. Welcome to the listeners out there on the stream, the folks in the chat room. We got a few people there, and we will be taking calls. The telephone call-in number is area code 610-616-5187. That is also on the chat room and streaming page at threshingfloor-radio.com. If you go to the front page of the website, there's the big graphic there that we put up, and there's information under that. We have a web page with an embedded chat room, and also a stream that kicks up when you go onto that page, so you can actually listen and chat right from the website. And that's all working real well tonight. I believe the stream is also better. We moved, we completely redid the streaming. I had a computer that was failing, so we moved that over onto a new computer as well. So hopefully you folks are hearing us out there, and we'll get some interaction. We'll probably open up the lines for calls in about a half an hour or so. And I also want to bring up something that Gordon, you had sent to me earlier this week. The last half hour tonight, let's open this up for prayer requests. That can be done via the chat room. It can be done by email. My email address is randymoggins@verizon.net. And if you're on Facebook, you can go to my Facebook page and also post there, or even send me a private message. But we want to open this up and be a ministry, too. I enjoy the talk show format, but I do recognize that we function for many people as a point of contact as a church as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and we're going to, you know, I don't want to spend, and I know we're not going to, a whole lot more time on this, because frankly, I'll just get cranky, and I don't want to be cranky. Hopefully, you know, Thanksgiving is another thing I've dealt with as well over the years, and I've looked at it more or less as a, you know, something that our nation dedicated itself to, although the date's wrong, and in fact there were multiple Thanksgiving declarations. The last one, the one that we live with presently, apparently came as a result of the Civil War. President Lincoln declared that. The original date was actually, I believe, October 3rd, so it comes rather late compared to what the original Thanksgiving holiday was, but I still find it meaningful enough that we dedicate ourselves to a day of thanks, although most people don't know who they're thanking, and in fact don't have the sense of gratitude.
Well, I can tell you, if you check out the public school history textbooks, by and large, they will
claim that the Pilgrims, that it was a day of thanks to the Indians. Nothing about a day of thanks to the Lord.
Well, the whole thing's a myth. I mean, really, there's no historical basis for them getting together and sharing whatever it was that they were supposed to have shared. It certainly wouldn't have been what we celebrate with today, which is genetically modified turkey and white bread stuffing and mashed potatoes and all the other accoutrements of a Thanksgiving meal. You know, whatever may have occurred there, most of it's more folk legend than any substance in history.
It really is folk legend because I've in recent years found out that the Pilgrims weren't all they were cracked up to be. I mean, here they had this festivity with the Indians, but apparently some Pilgrims actually were involved in massacres against the Indians. There were those colonists whose hearts were pure, and I would point to the Moravians as far as that goes. There were genuine white settlers who were interested in converting the Indians. The Pilgrims, I think, were kind of hit and miss.
You know, that's an interesting period, and you've talked about this on your shows as well, that there really was a heart for evangelism, and that really that whole thing got blown up rather quickly due to the intrigues and the fact that we then had a war of genocide against, you know, the tribes here. And on the other go ahead, please.
The war of genocide, it was perpetrated by white Americans who claimed to be Christians. And you see this kind of the same thing today. White Americans claiming to be Christians, sending their sons, and now, shamefully enough, even their daughters, signing them up to be cannon fodder in Iraq and Afghanistan, in these wars of empire. It's just totally shameful and anti-Christian. It's awful. The history of those claiming to be Christians. The remnants looking smaller to me all the time. And actually, not that I'm a total pacifist, I don't think, but the remnant is looking to be more and more pacifist to me as I get older.
Well, you know about Francis Bacon's New Atlantis and his whole theory about how this is going to be the new promised land. And of course, behind a lot of the genocide and slaughter was what happened they were trying to duplicate what happened in the Old Testament with the Canaanites and the other tribes and their land of milk and honey, simply to purge and claim the land of all of its native population. So they saw themselves, out in an errand in the wilderness, so to speak. So this is why a lot of these genocides were tolerated, because they somehow saw, this land is a new Israel, the place where the new kingdom was going to be, established for the rule of the world.
And they were treating the Indian like the Hittites and the Jebusites and extinguishing them.
And all of giving them smallpox, tainted blankets and all the other things that were going on at the time. I mean, there were whole manuals written about how to wipe out various tribes.
But you don't get this in the words of Jesus Christ or in the example of him anywhere. He was about converting people through love.
This is a kind of a segue into the other, what I had talked to Randy about, was this whole vision of God, which has been propagated and promulgated by the well-meaning Christians. Basically of this kind of conquering, wrathful, angry, sovereign, sovereignty of these, of the conquering kings of Europe. And this is an image of God that has been, perpetuated by these people and trying to be propped up by the various, religious, political, and economic establishment. And I think that's part of the problem. That's part of, this is not consistent with the God of love of the New Testament.
Well, Well,
definitely not.
There's, no, there's a, and you know, I struggle with this a lot. There's a balance in all of this. From an historical standpoint, you know, it was obvious there were tribal wars going on with the Indians as well. I mean, they waged their own internal wars with each other. And, you know, to that end, we can't say, well, it was the noble savage. I don't buy into that either.
No.
On the other hand, we waged a war of attrition against people who were here for conquest and gain as well. And I think that kind of balances the scales a little bit more. I mean, clearly, justifiable war would be war in defense of a nation from invasion. And again, you know, the whole point of it is, you can't go to war without God. You know, if you're going to fight, you better have Yahweh on your side, because He definitely is the deciding factor in war, and Scripture is very clear on that.
I would even take it a step farther and say you can't go to war unless it's complete with God, of course, but also unless it's completely defensive. Because I'm going through again, and I'm making shows out of this time, because I think more people need to know about this. I'm going through the work of James Montgomery on my show, his online book called The United States is Still a British Colony. And he basically writes how the founding fathers sold us out. They were elitists, and they made a corporate charter with Britain, with the King of England, called the Constitution. It never gave us any real rights. It gave us privileges, which the king knew he was going to get back. And basically, you hear stories about, like, the Black Brigade, these very brave and virtuous the pastors.
Oh, yeah.
In the United States, who led the militia, led the Minutemen, and fought so bravely in the American Revolutionary War. But you know what? Even though they did all that, they were sold out at the top by the elitist lawyers like Washington and even Patrick Henry, who was probably the most virtuous of them all, but he was still a lawyer. And I look around today, and I'm a school teacher, as you know, and I, every year, when I talk to my seniors, I find three or four, nowadays it's five or six or seven of them, who are already signed up to the Army or the Marines, and they're getting sent over to Iraq, and I can tell from talking to them, they come from corporate Christian families. And those are the ones, by and large, who were the most patriotic, sending their sons and, shamefully again, their daughters nowadays to go fight in these wars. And I think, you know what, it was the same back then, 200-plus years ago in the American Revolution. It was the well-meaning Christian families who were sending their sons to be cannon fodder for this American Revolution, and all they did was... it was meaningless because they were sold out at the top. You know, you say what you want about the American Revolution and what it did to me, what I know now about the Constitution being a fraud. It was meaningless.
Well, one of the things that kind of opened my eyes about all of that was when I actually went and read the Treaty of Paris.
Yes, and King George dictating the terms?
Yes. And then the Treaty of Guelph, after the War of 1812 was resolved, and you go and you actually read those treaties, it gives you a whole different perspective on what was going on. I mean, the king was entitled to keep all of his lands, and mm-hmm. those lands that he was relinquishing, there would have to be payment made in gold in perpetuity. These are not the terms of allegedly, someone that has lost a revolution. They don't dictate the terms.
The loser doesn't set the terms of a treaty. And yet that's what happened there.
And, when you think about it, Britain at the time was the largest empire in the world and had a huge navy and huge forces. To think that a few hundred thousand colonists could mount a successful revolution against the British Empire and get total and complete independence to do whatever they wanted. It's a fantasy. It's part of this myth.
You know what, of that myth, the biggest thing that stuck out with me, and I didn't even come across this, I don't think, in James Montgomery's work or even the Informer's work, and both of those guys are on atgpress.com, againstthegrainpress.com. But just from my own reading elsewhere, when I found out that General Cornwallis, who surrendered at Yorktown to George Washington, and that was the end of the Revolutionary War and the British lost, when I found out that that guy, when he went home to England, he was not demoted, he was promoted to colonial India, and he had a stellar career after that. He had nothing but victories before and after the American Revolutionary War. He was actually a very good general, and his career only went on the increase after his humiliating loss at Yorktown. That tells me there was an inside deal there, probably Masonic and lawyerly, of course. If you look at history and look at other battles, whenever a general has suffered a terribly humiliating defeat, they are always taken down, always demoted. He was promoted.
Actually, it was Ghent. I'm sorry, I misspoke before about the Treaty of Ghent in the Netherlands. And the signatories to that were, well, among them, Alexander Hamilton. And we know about Hamilton's history and the first problem with the first bank. Going back to what we talked about earlier, the talisman and the money changers, the so-called banksters or bankers, as we like to call them. All of this goes back to the, you know, who was going to have the economic control of the United States. And the people that signed that treaty, all of them were agents of the British government. I mean, how do you have a treaty where all the signatories of that basically can be shown to be working for the British government?
Well, if they were lawyers, then they had the title Esquire after them, which is a title of nobility subject to the King of England.
And this is a situation that we're in, and have been in, that nothing is what it appears to be. Everything is the opposite of what you think it is.
Yes.
And that's the hardest thing for most people to grasp, is that, you know, the United States, of course, by federal statute, is a corporation. The states are corporations, the municipalities are corporations, and the corporations are chartered ultimately and registered in England. They're not even registered here. And, you know, and it's a copyright when you apply to get a corporate name. And, of course, what are you granted? You're granted by the king, by the sovereign, by the crown. The, limited liability. That veil of sovereign immunity is placed over you. And this goes all the way back to, you know, the prior discussions about 501(c), you know, church, nonprofit corporations, granting you limited liability. All of it is about not having to be responsible for your own actions, for your own decisions. Placing yourself under the veil of the corporate sovereign granted immunity.
Hey, absolutely, and you know this, Ev. You and I both are affected by this. We're both are in the business of insurance. You personally and my wife, and it's totally anti-scriptural. Look at how God set up his government in Israel. It was strict liability, not limited. And that's insurance is limited.
Drawing
well, the whole principle of insurance is contrary to the scriptures.
Yeah.
You should be responsible for your actions. If you're a doctor and you've committed medical malpractice, you should be financially responsible for the consequences of your actions. There shouldn't be some third party that comes in to protect you from the consequences of your own negligence, your own malfeasance.
Nobody's responsible for their actions anymore. There is no real justice except what you can go by. It depends on the social scale of things, but as I'm discovering right now, it's very difficult to get justice on any approachable level. I just, I had a contractor who basically has, well, I hired a contractor to put an addition onto our home, and that same contractor was also doing work on the home that my parents lived in. And apparently the guy, I don't know what happened to him, but he disappeared with my money and work unfinished. And my only recourse now is to hire a very expensive attorney and go through litigation and sue him civilly, because apparently they don't consider this to be fraud anymore. You know, the remedy to the common man is no longer in the small courts. And so, you know, I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, what's my remedy here? I'm told by the attorneys that I have to pursue civil litigation, that there's no criminality in walking out on a contract. That's all civil law.
Because you're dealing no longer with a real human being, but with a corporate fiction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which goes back to the whole tie-in with the military, and then, of course, the corporate churches, which were brought into the corporate veil as well via 501c3. And obviously they understand who their God really is, because that's who they now serve. They serve corporate structures and corporatized human beings as well. Hey, did anybody ever go into this whole thing with Rudyard Kipling and the white man's burden? I mean, I know this has come up before, but it is kind of the shift. It was really the British Empire handing off the torch to the United States, the colonies, under the mantle of war and exploitation. I'm going to read you one stanza of this poem, because
I've read it.
This is the most hideous thing at all. Take up the white man's burden, send forth the best ye breed, go bind your sons to exile, to serve your captives' needs, to wait in heavy harness on fluttered folk and wild, your new-caught sullen peoples, half devil and half child. What was this guy into?
Well, Freemasonry, for one thing. Let's go read the man who would be king, or any of the...
Yes. That is the most blatantly Freemasonic movie ever made.
Well, the book is even more so. I was a huge fan of Kipling when I was a teenager.
Yeah. He's extolled.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I tried reading him.
That poem, if, was became like a, you know, in my pre-Christian days, became like a talisman for me, to go back to the term. I would read that, I would chant that, and this was what the characteristics I thought of what it meant to be a man. And, you know, that's a huge part of, you know, of the culture of the British Empire, what a soldier is. I mean, just if you read that, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, and if you can put all your winnings, together and lose them in one, in one toss.
Then you'll
be a madman.
Yeah.
The perfect metaphor for the relationship between Britain, United States, that began when we were colonized by Britain and continues to this day, the perfect metaphor for that, and I didn't think this up, it was Visigoth, and I'm sure you've heard it, but you remember that movie, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
Right.
You remember Master Blaster, with the big, huge guy with the midget riding his back.
Yep.
Yeah.
That is Britain. Britain's the little midget riding our back, and we're the muscle.
And that's the whole point of why we have all armies all over the world and 135 military bases, they said, and, you know, close to 2 million men in arms, you know, allegedly protecting American interests. But, of course, ultimately, it's British interests, and behind that, it's the crown. And, you know, a lot of people think, well, you know, this is the... war, you know,
up from there. As you know,
this is
you
the
can
royal,
go up for...
And, you know, and ultimately, you know, there are papal claims as well, the Vatican, you know, and behind all of this is that those ruling families that control the banks and control, you know, the talismans. and going all the way back then to Black Friday today, while we go out like trained monkeys, you know, buying the products that that allow them to be in the black. Think about that. For them to be profitable, that they've chosen the terminology.
Yes.
Is for them to be in the black.
Well, the whole thing really shows you the level of servitude we have and how much we harbor the illusion that we're free men. We're not free. We're impulse-driven. We're driven by our desires, and our desires are parlayed to us by Madison Avenue, the giant machine of mind control. I mean, that's what advertising and marketing basically is. It tells you what your needs are.
And remember I told you that I walked into Kmart and I saw stacked hundreds of these 32-inch and 52-inch plasma screen TVs. See, what people don't realize, going back to what Gordon said about 1984, is these are the instruments scientifically designed to brainwash, to mesmerize, and to go to the next level of programming for people.
Let me bring something up here.
These are the talus screens.
I couldn't say anything because at work when this happened, because I would be looked upon like I had three heads, you know. But they always every year in teaching anymore in public schools, they encroach a little bit every year more and more how much they're going to tell you what to teach. It's kind of like the income tax, where every year what you have to pay the government gets, it's first, it's April 10th, and it's May 1st, and then because the income tax keeps going up, and they set up this arbitrary date where you have to work this much to pay off your taxes. Well, every year now, we have to teach more and more, you know, what No Child Left Behind basically tells us what we got to teach. And then once we teach that stuff that we got to teach, then we can actually use our brains and our own creativity and teach what we want to teach as imaginative, you know, post-grad college people would teach. Lost my train of thought.
Well, yeah, basically, you're being dictated to because you are the servant of the state in that role.
I just remembered this. One of my fellow co-workers, good guy, but he presented this article he found from some popular magazine, I forget which, but it was talking about, it was an editorial piece about how fantastic we have it today. It talked about how it mentioned like the names of royalty back in the 1600s or 1200s, and how these, even the kings back then, they had all of this opulent stuff, but they didn't have a cell phone, and they didn't have the internet, and they didn't have this, and they didn't have that. And, you know, it totally flied in the face of what even George Carlin knew as an unbeliever.
Exactly.
And you did a fantastic show about George Carlin. He said, look, folks, we Americans today are so dumbed down because they let us play around with cell phones that can, as George Carlin put it, cell phones that can make pancakes. and that entertains us and keeps us distracted from the rights they are taking away from us.
You know,
Yeah.
The opposite of that's actually true if you look at how distracted we are now. I'm looking at people whose lives are centered around entertainment and television and pop culture figures. These are the conversations now that people have. They want to know who was eliminated in Dancing with the Stars. People were thrilled. I guess Donny Osmond was on this show, and I guess Donny Osmond made the grade. Well, what a surprise. But you know, the thing about it is, to have the kind of conversation that we're having tonight with the average working bloke out there is nearly impossible. They're too distracted now. They're hurting, they're limping, They wonder why everything's all screwed up, but there's no meaning in their lives anymore. They're distracted. They have Twitter. They have Facebook. They have cell phones. They've got their computers. Their giant LCD TV screens, which are now, as Ev pointed out, coming down to a place where pretty much everybody can have them. You know, the quality of entertainment that we got on a 26-inch black and white TV when I was a child was so superior to what we have with 156 satellite channels now in a high definition digital, that why bother? You know, it's become a mockery because our minds have shriveled, our attention spans have been pruned to the point where we're not able to hold discourse on subjects of real substance anymore.
And Ray Bradbury's dystopic world of non-reading automatons engaged in interaction with three-dimensional, you know, television programs in their living rooms. Is
Fahrenheit,
that's the vision that we have. That's the world in which we're very close to. I mean, what's it, 3D technology with
well,
James
Cameron? Ev, you remember, in Fahrenheit 451, Ev, you remember that everybody had wall-sized televisions?
Mm-hmm.
And what do we have now?
Go to wall-sized TV? Go to Times Square in New York.
I saw this even when I was a child, what the progression was going to be. And, you know, one of the things that people don't realize is that the technology that they're rolling out now is about 30 years behind the times of what they, you know, of what is being done in laboratories and in secret DARPA, you know, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency laboratories.
Yeah.
You know, by the way, speaking of television, to the listeners out there, I'll just point out again that if you want an eye-opening discourse on television and media, Ev has a book out called Visionary. We've talked about it on the Threshing Floor, and you can go search
out. I'm still reading it,
yeah. Yeah, you can still go, just go to the search engine on the Threshing Floor website and type in either Ev's name or type in Visionary. I highly recommend this book just because, yeah, it's going to challenge you to read, and you're going to have to read dialogue, and you're going to have to deal with some substance. But there are so few books out there now that are written from a substantial point of view that I'm going to plug this book until my eyes bleed. Visionary by
Christian
Michael
Fixon,
Halford.
That's not about the rapture? Yeah.
Well, thanks again for the plug.
No, really, I can't say this enough. There's a lot of levels inside that book, and one of them deals with this very subject. Because we're dealing
with... That was something that God placed on my heart, you know, nearly 30 years ago, what television was going to become. And I've now witnessed it with my own eyes. That's why I said I'm wandering around the store. And it was very oppressive for me. When I walked into this Kmart, I was going in there just to walk around for a few minutes because I had time to kill to wait for this train to go on. And I walked in there and saw... As I said, it must have been a couple of hundred of these, and it was one of the most frightening things I'd ever seen. It reminded me of that opening scene in, you know, the before the, you know, the one with Richard Burton, made in I think 83 and released in 84. You know, those huge screens. We're not that far from that now.
No.
You know, we're very close to realizing that total mind control from the television screen that, you know, that Orwell, you know, envisioned back in 1948 when he wrote the book.
Well, and we get to pay for the privilege now because free broadcasting is gone. Do you know anybody now that's getting over-the-air television any longer? I mean, we were trained into this, and in February of this year when they started, when the over-the-air analog signals started to go dark, the marginalized few, I guess, out there that didn't have satellite or cable basically were forced to deal with it last. But the fact of the matter is that we now pay for our own mind control. We pay for our internet connections, our cell phones, pretty much anything that enters our eyes and ears now. Radio is the last vestige, and there's not much left of that worth hearing. Which is why people were buying Sirius and XM radios and putting them in their cars, just because you need that many channels now to find anything of substance, and you would have to define substance from a baseline that I don't see in the media at all now. News is complete propaganda. Entertainment has reached the level where basically we listen to hookers and pimps and limp wrists singing love songs to us all day. So, I mean, really, what's left of that culture out there, and what are we paying for anyway?
By the way, that triggered a memory of something. You know, I don't watch television very often, but, you know, I was watching this program, and they had an advertisement for The Gap. And it was a bunch of kids, you know, dressed in, you know, Christmas colors, dancing around and chanting in a kind of, you know, rhythm, almost a military chant, as though they were marching. And I actually sat and, you know, and listened to the chant, and it was, no more Christmas, no more Kwanzaa, no more winter solstice festival, no more, we don't celebrate anything, let's deep 86 all rules and do whatever we want.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-oh.
And this was the chant.
Huh?
This was the chant that they were chanting as they were doing this dance. And I'm thinking, how more blatant can they be? Most people aren't even listening to it. I had to focus my attention. It was very difficult to make out the words they were saying. And I'm saying, this is another one of the examples of how subtle they are, how profound they are at the technology, and basically planting these ideas inside people's heads. Not to say that, you know, that, and you, that, this hasn't been going on for over 100 years since Edward Bernays, but this is the circumstance situations we have now with the television. I mean, it's the perfect instrument, you know, with the 60 cycles per second and the frequency, you know, putting you into an alpha state, making you already, you know, susceptible to whatever voice suggestions that, and you know, neuro-linguistic programming that, you know, that they're putting through the television set. I mean, they wouldn't be spending all these billions of dollars, you know, for ads for, you know, various drugs. And the fact that the drugs and the pharmaceuticals are the major financiers, you know, along with the car companies, of most of the advertising on television now. I mean, when we were kids, it used to be breakfast cereals and soaps. But now it's almost...
And if I can take it a step, maybe what I think might be a step farther... and getting into the spiritual world. Satan knows that in God's design of the family unit, the man is to be the head. And what you've made the observation, and I think it's totally hitting the nail on the head. Who is it that is most easily brainwashed by what was the 60 cycles a second, the flickering of the TV screen? It's males who are more easily brainwashed by it because we're more visual. I think Satan had a hand in the design of that, just like I think Satan had a hand in the design of the vaccinations that caused 9 out of 10 babies to be, that are autistic, are going to be male. It's an attack against maledom. It's an attack to whittle down what would be the natural middle class defense against the elitist satanic plans of this new world order. You got to take out the men first, and they've done that superbly.
And they have to kill the natural capacity for empathy that's in men. What made men heroic was their capacity for empathy. All the characteristics about men would see a child drowning, that man would rush into that river to save that child.
Yes.
Because he could imagine his own child drowning.
Yes.
And that is what has been targeted by the biochemically, pharmacologically, you know, through the technology, through the cell phone technology itself, interfering with your brain chemistry. This is what they're targeted.
And in the entertainment field, that's been targeted big time, because if you watch any movie now, especially Pixar or Disney movies, whenever they have a male save a female character or save anybody's life, they always have to follow it up with the female saving the male's life. It has to be this radical egalitarianism like that.
One of the things that I've noticed in the few TV shows that I still watch, and I don't watch many, is the role of females, especially in cop shows now. You have a TV show out there. The guy is like, he's not a psychic, but I'm trying to think of the name of the show.
The Mentalist?
The Mentalist. And
I've never seen it.
The show is actually clever and witty, but what bothers me about it is this guy, who's very suave and very intelligent, and obviously he's like the clue master, he's bossed around every week by, and I can't find a better term for this, so I'll just say it, by this really bitchy woman who is dragging him around by his organ. It's pathetic to watch this show and see him,
wow,
see this woman snap at this guy every week and treat him like he's some kind of puppy dog that just soiled the carpet. I mean, and that's...
I didn't know that.
And that's a role that you see more and more in most of these, like, CSI-type shows as well. The authority figure is female. Now,
yes,
I'm not necessarily against equality, but my experience at working under a woman superior hasn't been quite that degrading. For the most part, I've been blessed with dealing with gracious women. Oh, I've met a few in my time that, you know, frankly, they wanted you to know that they had stones, but as a general rule, I haven't seen that. This is role modeling by proxy on television. It's designed to make the man understand what his role is towards women's superiors and basically have your face rubbed in it.
Well, this is the new, the so-called New World Order, the uplifting and the turning over of the old order.
Well, a matriarchal society is a satanic society. Every time that you've seen the rise of matriarchy, you've seen the rise of Satanism.
However, you guys, isn't it true that at the top levels, the males are in charge among the oligarchs? It's only the middle class, the regular folk, that they want to be emasculated.
Yeah, usually you'll have some smart-ass kid that's basically he's a controller too. You know, it's like a complete role reversal. We went from father knows best to Homer Simpson.
And that was the concerted plan, as I've said in many times, that this is, you know, they're taking us through a progression, and there's a gradualism about it. Now they seem to be more blatant about it than ever. They had to get us to this point. They had to destroy this image of the heroic man symbolized by John Wayne. And, you know, I didn't like the Western hero motif and methodology any more than what we have now, because I think, you know, it was all about, you know, justifying the slaughter of the Indians. I mean, the whole point of all those Western movies was how we were right. You know, these savage people needed to be murdered. And, you know, that was in response to, you know, the genocide that had been committed, you know, in the last century. I mean, Hollywood very quickly, you know, sought to justify, you know, what had been done in the so-called Wild West.
You know, I think being in New York City last weekend, and I'm not trying to be making sweeping generalities, but let's face it, when you're in New York and you have thousands of people moving around you, and I spend a lot of time watching people. It's one of my interests. I can't help but notice the complete feminization of men in an urban setting, and it's so obvious now. And I mean, look, I lived in New York City for a period of time in the late 70s. I've been in and out of New York over the years, but I was stunned by the rapidity with which I noticed how effeminate men now acted, and even more so how robotic most people in a city setting seem to be. These were just observations I made, having not been in New York for, probably a decade.
Well, I've seen this, and we've been in New York now since 1991, so it's 19, almost 19 years. I've seen this complete transformation in the way people behave, the lack of spontaneity.
Yep, I saw that too.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember when we were first coming into New York. They had all kinds of people begging and on the subways, and you know, trying to sell newspapers for the homeless, and you know, the city was full of a lot of cacophony, a lot of noise. And now everybody sits sedately on the subway. You know, there's no real, you know,
wow,
life in them anymore.
That's crazy.
And I violated, you know, one of the unwritten rules of riding the train home one day. I started a conversation with someone, and I was getting the dirtiest looks that I had ever gotten in my life from people. How dare you speak to someone on a train?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's like a partition around people. You don't enter that space. Hey, I want to take a break here, and I also want to invite people to call in. We'll just take an hour break here so that I can cut the show in half to make file downloads for the podcast a little easier for the folks out there. Here's what I'd like to do. I'm going to bring some music up, and you guys can grab a drink of water or coffee or whatever you need to do, about 5 minutes. And I said, we've got a lot of people in the chat room. That's great. The stream's working really well, and I'm going to invite you to call in. The dial-in number, again, is area code 610-616-5187. If you have Skype and you want to come in that way, all you have to do is search Skype, watchman.live, and you can come in on Skype. If you want to come in and just hang out and listen and contribute to the show, that's great. If you have a comment, I'm watching the chat room. They're bringing up all kinds of interesting things, and I'll check email on the break as well. So we'll take a break at this point and come back in about 5 minutes. And continue with the second half of The Watchman Live. I'm Randy Moggins, and I have Ev Halford and Gordon Comstock. We will be right back.
Oh, last chance.